Dawkins, and I am accompanied here today by Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
We're here today to discuss an upcoming game. By the time this is up, in fact, it will be on Kickstarter. It's a very exciting game. It is Dystopia Rising. And Dystopia Rising is going to be the, I guess, second or third game that we do a good old deep dive into. Because we, of course, did this for Requiem, Vampire the Requiem. We have done this to a limited degree with Pugmire, Monarchies of Mao. And now we're on to Dystopia Rising, which is timely because, as I say, the Kickstarter is currently running. And it's a very exciting time for Onyx Path because there's a new licensing partner in the form of Eschaton Media. Dystopia Rising has a massive fan base in the world of live-action role players. And it's a brand new project because we don't often get to explore a, I guess, contemporary feeling post-apocalyptic horror, if you can put all of that in the same line.
Right.
You totally can.
Well, I have, and I'll do it again, damn it.
You can't stop me.
Try to stop me. Try to boot me from this call. But actually, before I let that threat rest... because they probably will. I am not going to be here for the full episode because of various personal obligations, and will therefore be handing host duties over to Dixie when my time is nigh. For the time being, however, I am still here. I will be able to ask questions, as will Dixie. And our guest for this episode will be someone who you very rarely hear from on this podcast. It's Mr. Edwin Fate himself. Eddie Webb, how are you? How far did you have to travel for this episode?
Oh, it was exhausting. I mean, and I'm such a huge fan of the Pathcast for so long. I'm glad I could finally be on. I really, really appreciate this opportunity.
You're a fan. It never felt that way.
Well, I mean, you know, just because I talk about you guys online doesn't mean I don't actually love you.
That's really, really good to hear. I mean, I guess you're kind of a fan since you spent all that time editing and, you know, mashing it together and...
Yes, I listen to your voices much, much more than you guys do.
You don't know how often I listen to my own voice.
That's true. Okay. I'm assuming.
You have no idea. I just put old Pathcast episodes on repeat while I'm working.
Well, undoubtedly in this episode we will be discussing other games as well as Dystopia Rising, but as that is the core of this episode, I would first of all like to ask Eddie, how did we come as Onyx Path to come to be developing Dystopia Rising?
That's an interesting question because I don't know all of the details on it. The initial discussions were happening before I became an in-house developer. And it was actually at Gen Con last year, so 2017, where I sat down with Ashley and Michael from Eschaton Media with Rich and Matt. And Rich was like, hey, I want you to come talk to the Dystopia Rising guys and see, you know, talk about the project. I was like, okay, cool. And then we start sitting down, and Rich is like, you know, this is Eddie Webb. And I'm like, hi. And it's like, yeah, he's going to be the line developer for Dystopia Rising. And I'm like, what? And he's like, no, we talked about this. And then at that point in time, the conversation we had 6 months ago flashed into my mind, where I did say, yeah, that might be a cool idea. But I had completely forgotten about it in the meantime. So... I was quickly kind of hitting the ground running of like, yes, no, this is totally a thing I want to do, and this is amazing. And they didn't buy it in the least, but they thought it was funny. So that was a good start to our relationship. But from what I understand is that it was kind of a meeting of the minds, if you will. Onyx Path has been wanting to look at live-action opportunities. I mean, you know, we used to make live-action games back when we weren't all, you know, the original White Wolf, and then Biden Studios has been doing a fantastic job with the World of Darkness LARP games. And Rich just doesn't feel like he understands live action to be able to directly in-house make those things. He would rather work with companies that know how to make live action games.
Right.
And so it was initially kind of, hey, would you guys be interested in doing, like, say, a Scion LARP? And then they're like, well, we also would like to make a tabletop game, a second edition of our Dystopia Rising tabletop game. And it's very much kind of in Onyx Path's wheelhouse of it's that action-venture horror dynamic that both World Darkness and Chronicles Darkness to various degrees inhabit, but it's a different setting. It's futuristic, much more Mad Max. And so is a lot of kind of, this speaks to our respective competencies. We at Onyx Path know really well how to make these kinds of role-playing games even better. Eschaton Media really knows how to make high-quality production live-action events. So it's like, this is a good fit. So my understanding is that's how the relationship kind of got started, was us helping each other out, and then we started talking about how the tabletop game's going to work.
And for those of you unfamiliar, if Eddie, you had to give, let's say it's a long elevator ride, but an elevator pitch for the setting of, we're going all the way up to the top of Hancock Tower right now in Chicago, so you've got a fair journey, and I would like you to explain to me in the elevator with you, I'm facing the wall, I'm being very odd, I'm one of those, those sort of ghouls that stands in the corner. And doesn't look at the doors, but you have got to explain to me the strange, creepy spectre in the elevator with you. See, this sounds like a good game on its own.
Why are you doing this to this ghoul?
They came from the first floor.
What dystopia? The problem is, the Prince of Chicago is living all the way on the top of Hancock Tower and has commanded me. He said, "You are not permitted to face any of our guests." So, anyway. We're going up the elevator. I've completely lost track.
Why are we role playing on the podcast right now?
Michael Bublé, I would like you to explain to me what Dystopia Rising is. What is the setting? Who am I? Where am I? And where
I can answer one of those questions. The other ones are all on you. You have to have some time and more self reflection, apparently, to figure out those questions. But
that's exactly what I intend to do when I take my sabbatical partway through this podcast. I'm going to go and walk off into the desert for so many days and so many nights to really get a good sense of who I am spiritually, and when I return I will be enlightened or dead.
So over
to you, Eddie.
So what I've extracted from all of that is you were like the elevator pitch for Dystopia Rising, which I'm going to assume is the answer, because I don't want to give you any more leeway to answer that question. So I'm just going to plow
on ahead. That is definitely what we want. That is exactly what we want. Please give us that. I do not know what's going on, but I know that at this point, if I were listening to this, I would never, ever want to be a guest on this podcast. So please, Eddie, bring us back.
So Dystopia Rising is it's actually set about 3 years after the ongoing live action Chronicle, but it sets several generations after the fall of humanity. And unlike Pugmire, we know exactly what happened. There was nuclear blasts, there were radioactive bursts, and a lot of people died. So it's very much The Walking Dead meets Mad Max. So like Walking Dead is kind of, you know, what happens 15 minutes after the apocalypse. This is 100 years later. There's psychic powers. Everyone is some form of mutant, for lack of a better term, which means that there are now 24 and counting distinct strains of humanity. And even the power of faith has gained some traction and foothold, so that people can actually use prayers to first spread infects. And all of this is against not only the Walking Dead, but also raiders, which are people who have lost themselves to the Grave Mind, which is this large overarching infection that has taken over and has rebuilt the planet in various ways.
That's awesome.
That's the elevator pitch.
Yeah, I usually think like Fallout, Mad Max, Walking Dead, like there are a lot of very popular media properties that kind of, you know, influence or are influenced by, you know, this kind of story. So.
Right, and one of the things that I found particularly compelling about the Dystopia Rising property, because when you start looking at it, it looks a lot, like you say, like very similar looking popular media properties, but the fact is that there's this concept of the Grave Mind where people actually can come back from the dead, not necessarily as zombies. They're actually literally rebuilt. But if they pass through the Gravemind experience and keep their sanity and their soul intact. They come back with most of their memories, but the emotional connections are gone.
Yeah, that was something that you were mentioning during the Gen Con panel, right? Yeah, the whole, like, you might come back and, you know, you don't really remember, like, being in love with your husband. Like, you're still there, but your, feelings aren't there anymore.
Exactly. And that's something we're bringing attention to, relatively new. The original Dystopia Rising property, they have what are called infection points, which are basically the number of times you can come back to life before you run out of infection points and you become a zombie. And I can understand, from a first design pass, why that would be an attractive option. Because, again, just the idea of coming back was itself interesting. Mm-hmm. But I felt there wasn't a lot of weight to that. It felt very video gamey to me, and that's actually what I called out when I talked to the Ashton Media folks about it, is I have four quarters, and I can play this game three times after I die, and that's it. And so it struck me as what would happen is the first three lives are kind of, I'll just waste those. And then as long as I don't lose that last one, I can keep playing. Mm-hmm. Whereas with this shift, each time you die, you're not entirely sure if you're going to come back. Because you're a player character, odds are pretty good you're going to come back, but you're also not going to come back the same way. You're going to be fundamentally changed on some level. And that struck me as more kind of, for lack of a better term, the Onyx Path aesthetic. Let's take a game mechanic and give it a layer of story. It's something we as a company are very good at.
So this is a distinct change. Sales-driven question, I guess. A marketing question, I suppose, and that is, how would you attempt to coax in? Let's start with the experienced Onyx Path game fan, and then move to the brand new role player. Should any be listening to this podcast, people who don't get a chance, what is it about this game that you feel would really appeal to both of those demographics?
I think from a new player perspective, I think it's pretty straightforward. Because again, the advantage of being similar on the surface to a lot of properties is something we talked about a bit on the Pugmire deep dive, which is that it's easy barrier to entry. Right? It's like, okay, I know how The Walking Dead works. I know how Mad Max works. So I make a character that's kind of like that, and I beat up zombies. And there's a surface level of the game that's very easy to approach. You know, there's not a lot of complexity to it. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of wrinkles that are unique to the game, like what faith am I a part of, or which strain do I choose? But those are, again, choices that are akin to other games, both tabletop role-playing games and video games. I pick my character type, I pick, you know, the thing that gives me whatever powers I love, and I jump into the game. So it's all pretty approachable, and then you start finding some of the depth of the game itself, the game world, some of the complex things the game itself is trying to, or the game mechanics are trying to show you. From an experienced player perspective, there's two kind of sides to that. For people who are familiar with Story Path, we've done some interesting tweaks to the story path system, particularly salvaging. It's basically going to be a lot of the game is salvaging equipment. You're taking scrap and you're making it to make other things go, and they will go for a certain period of time and then stop, and you have to fix them again. So there's going to be all of your equipment, a lot of it's going to have flaws and so forth, and you're going to try to always getting new things to try to defeat those flaws. It's a way to give a story-driven system, a kind of an economy, which is very important to Dystopia Rising as a concept, without actually making it, I have a car engine and two batteries and a pair of glasses, what can I make out of this? It's all kind of aggregated into scrap. Mm-hmm. But if you have a car that has a condition stalled, so I need to fix that. And I fixed that, but now it has dodgy steering. So I get some more scrap to fix the dodgy steering. So now it runs and the steering's pretty good, but then I get a flat tire. So now I have to fix the flat tire condition. And that's kind of the cycle that's always happening, is that there's always going to be something else breaking down and you're always trying to fix it. So that's one side of it, is there's an interesting kind of economy that's happening, but it all happens through story. Another side of this, something I mentioned in panels we did at Gen Con, is that if you have eight members of your survivor group and six of them have the condition hungry, all of them the condition hungry, but you have six pieces of food to resolve those conditions, that means that two people have to go hungry. Again, it's that kind of give and take resource-based decision-making that is very popular for things like The Walking Dead and Mad Max, but not in a very codified way. It all focuses on story. The other side of it is the fact that this is a ground we haven't quite covered except for maybe Promethean, in the sense of what happens when you come back from the dead. And in a lot of ways, we're blurring the lines between what is a zombie and what is a survivor. There are certain strains where you look entirely like a zombie. In fact, your condition is people quickly confuse you as a zombie unless you convince them you're not. And they become comfortable around you because you look so much like a zombie. And on the flip side, as you slowly erode, you keep coming back and what constitutes yourself, it gets constantly removed. That's another compelling, that's closer, weirdly, to things like, say, the Prisoner TV show, the erosion of identity. It's something that we touch on in, like I said, Promethean, we touch on in some of the vampire games, but this particular cycle, I don't think we've ever really dug into before. So it's something that it provides an experience that people who have played Chronicles of Darkness, who have played World of Darkness, will go, oh, I'm into this style of emotional roleplay, but it's not a direct lift from any of those experiences.
That's really awesome that, like, you're able to kind of bring the emotion into the action game, too, because I like both kinds of gaming a lot. I'm a big fan of, you know, action. Okay, we're going to go shoot zombies or mash them on the head with, you know, sledgehammers or whatever. But I also do like to actually have connections and talk things out and make decisions with other players. So it sounds like you've really figured both of those things out, which is something that LARP does really well, but sometimes tabletop sometimes doesn't, sometimes does, depending on the system. But I think StoryPath can really handle that, and I think that all of us coming from our Chronicles World of Darkness background kind of, you know, can jump on that, too.
That was something that was made very clear to me, because it is a live action game at heart. Community is a big part of it, and it makes sense. I mean, you know, from a live action perspective, these large group of people meet in this very specific geographical location and deal with problems. So naturally, stable communities are going to be a cornerstone for how those games run, and that needs to be reflected somehow in the game. But I felt that there's an extra step there that makes potentially compelling, because in a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction as written, either you have a solo protagonist or two protagonists who are them against the whole world, sometimes literally.
Right.
Or it's all about betrayal. Everyone is ultimately going to betray you because everyone's out in it for themselves. And I couldn't start from that point. I absolutely can't. So I was like, okay, so what can we bring to the table? And the fact is that, you know, by having that communal point, it means that, you know, we have to have emotional connections, which means there's a lot of the games based around groups. You know, and StoryPath has built in the idea of society paths and whatnot. So that's really easy to kind of build that, and the emotional bonds and the actual bond system. So taking those components, okay, this is how we build communities. And when you put a lot of value on community and personal relationships, and then when you come back from death, you strip those relationships away, then you start to get a sense of what you're actually losing, in a way that you can keep playing your character, but you have lost something. But the only way to have the conceit of you don't have an emotional resonance with your friends anymore work is you have to kind of turn on its ear the assumption of post-apocalyptic tropes of everyone's out to betray you, because they, well, I don't care, they're going to kill me anyway, so I don't care if I don't like them. You have to make that a compelling experience and a mechanically valuable experience. Like you get dots and powers and dice based on your relationships with people, much more closer to, say, the Persona games than anything else. And then once you strip that away, then it becomes, okay, wow, actually, I really miss having those extra dice. I really miss having access to those powers. So now I need to get that back somehow. So that's an arc I really had to think through. And again, luckily, the Extra Time Media folks were very, very receptive. I was able to kind of, at the early stages, say, here's where my head's at. Here are the things that, after reading your property, I'm able to kind of extract and see as important. Am I on the same page? And we had some conversations back and forth, but they were very receptive to me tweaking and adjusting and modifying their setting to add these new mechanical components that make the whole cycle work better and stronger, I think.
Right.
So I've got a question, and it's regarding bad guys, because in our favorite apocalyptic movies, our favorite horror movies, they are largely defined by the people you are up against. And what kind of foes, thrilling antagonists, are a group of characters likely to come up against in a game of Dystopia Rising? And this is a genuine point of curiosity to me, because I'm always drawn into a game by the bad guys.
That's fair. And there are kind of four rough categories, I would say. The two biggest ones are zombies, which in the game world they're called Zed for short, which I think you'll appreciate, Matthew. The fact is there's a wide variety of zombies. A lot of, I wouldn't say zombie fiction, but zombie games have proliferated the concept of wildly different zombie types. If you watch, Night of the Walking Dead or some of the older zombie films, zombies are kind of in a rough template and they're all roughly slow moving walking zombies. But video games, you have to have different challenges. And so I think that kind of informs a bit more of this design. So you have big, huge, massive Goliath zombies that are, you know, somehow have grown to like 10 feet tall because somehow when they were regrown by the grave mines, they were made 150% bigger than usual. And so you have these huge zombies, or you have, fast-moving zombies. You have just your normal shamblers. You have bursters. You know, big, large, corpulent zombies that actually explode all over you. Every time you see a zombie, you're not necessarily, at least if you're new to the game, aware of what that their response is going to be. You learn over time. Certain kinds of zombies have certain things and certain defenses. We also have, like most of our storyteller games, a how to build your own antagonist, so you can build your own zombies. That way, even players who are familiar with the game can run across brand new types that don't work the same way. The next group are the raiders, which are cannibalistic people. They have taken to eating the flesh of other strains, and that has driven them irretrievably insane. I mean, I try to avoid that term, but in this case, it is a valid. The fact is that they don't think the same way as people, and it's not a compatible situation. It's not neurodivergent. It's they genuinely want to destroy everything around them. The grave mine has driven them into a pathological state that's almost persistent. But there's a wide variety of these raider clans as well. And in the game world, there may be characters who think that raiders can be saved, but we're pretty clear in the book, it's like they can't be. There's something that's driving them. It's not that they're misunderstood. There's an alien virus that's infecting their brain because they're eating the flesh of people to make them take these horrible actions. And those are very flavorful, I would say, characters. So we're looking at things like doctors and the like, who have gone crazy and want to tear people apart as opposed to healing them. Doll-like characters that have they look strikingly and oddly beautiful, and just repeat themes over and over again to draw people in, a bit like sirens.
That sounds awesome and creepy. I love stuff like that. Sorry, like, you know, zombies and viscera and all that, you know, stuff, and raiders and like whatever. But then when you get to the, you know, beautiful people or like innocent looking children that turn around and are actually really creepy, that's what always gets me in media. So
yeah, and that's what the raiders bring to it, is that because they're not undead, quote unquote, it allows for a more human face to antagonists that gives a different flavor and friction. That's closer to, say, Borderlands, where you have the psychos in hockey masks or whatever. These are more kind of human shaped antagonists, but they're still acting in ways that are, you don't feel too bad about having to do horrible things to them because they're going to do horrible things to you if you just don't stop them.
Yeah, I've definitely like. First of all, you just brought up my favorite video game of all time. Borderlands 2, but yeah. I think Borderlands does a really good job of that, actually, where they do, like, you occasionally do feel really bad for the bad guys. Because when you listen to their conversation sometimes, or you are interacting with a specific one, like, they're actually super tragic. But mm-hmm. then you have to kill them because they're just going to blow you up anyway. So that's something that I think... We were talking in our video game episode about, you know, running a game inspired by video games, and I'm like, I would totally run a Dystopia Rising Evolution game inspired by some of the Borderlands 2 bad guys. That'd be awesome.
Absolutely, and you know, it was actually a tricky balance because we were trying to make sure that the language we're using and the way we're presenting it is, like, you know, we weren't trying to say that people with mental illness are worthy of gunning down. That's absolutely what we're trying to say. This is a very distinct condition that is irretrievable. They're undead in a different way, kind of, in a lot of ways. But they're much more kind of like you say, you know, they're visibly approachable in a sense of you could see yourself, and also, you know, with the fact that you wake up and you're dead inside, you know, eventually you might start going, will I eventually become like them?
Mm-hmm. And there's a question. Maybe there. You will. Like, that could be a character arc, I'm assuming.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is entirely possible that might happen. And then the smaller groups, there's animals, just because weird radiation-modified animals are cool and surprisingly in my wheelhouse is a thing I'm known for.
What? You?
Yeah, right? And we actually had some discussions about that. There aren't as many animals as I originally planned to put in there because Eshita made a good point. Is like, from a live-action perspective, it's hard to represent animals at live action, so the role of animals has decreased just kind of naturally through that respect.
Yeah.
Since tabletop, we had that opportunity. I wanted to make sure they were showcased a bit more, so we kind of came to a consensus for the core book. You know, there's a few examples just kind of show people they exist and they're around, and here's ways to make more of them. But that's a good place for kind of support material to kind of dig into.
Yeah, totally. It could be like a dystopizing antagonist and bestiary book if we really wanted to for the tabletop. So that
right,
could
exactly.
be a fun support material thing.
And in fact, some of the stretch goals for the Kickstarter will be a threat book.
You mean R? You mean R, the Kickstarter that is running right now been running for a week and a half and has made millions of dollars. No, I don't know. It's
All of those are absolutely true statements and not at all projective.
Also, I have taken over at this point. Matthew is gone. So go me. I win. I have won hosting battle.
You won before, too, with your Sailor Moon reference.
Yeah, no, I always win. It's okay.
Sailor Moon reference that crashed Zencaster.
So are those all of the various antagonist types, really?
Well, yeah, and the last one is other people. Because that's kind of while it is a post-apocalyptic trope, we're not leaning into as heavily. It's still very valid, and particularly, like, you know, the idea of there being slavers is a thing in the game. It is a much more reduced thing in the game than it was previously, because it's just not a storyline that Eshita Media wants to continue to explore. But the idea that people are going to capture others in horrible situations and take advantage of them is not a concept that's going to go away. So make sure that the more position them into slavers are people that you beat up because they're awful.
Yeah, I mean, usually, even in dystopian fiction, when you see them presented, they're generally presented as bad guys. You know, it's not like this is what you aspire to be.
Right.
I'm not saying that some group somewhere may go off the rails and do that, but that's generally not aspirational. Let's just keep it there, you know?
Right, and because we're doing a tabletop game, that's one thing that is important that I don't think a lot of people think about when they do conversions one way or the other. In a live-action game, if you want a element of society to be persistent, players have to embody it in some way.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not going to just be on camera, as it were. In a tabletop game, you have to be a little clearer about what are aspirational characters and what are not.
Well, yeah, because in LARPs, you generally have people playing the antagonists. Now, it's
right.
often clear that they are the antagonists, but that's what happens. That's how LARP works. Whether it's NPC type players playing them or, you know, actual players are allowed to play antagonists, but it's still a thing that people have to embody. But at the table, the story guide can embody that. You know, they can say, like, this is the really bad guy. Don't be like him. You should probably go hit him with a hammer, you know?
Right, and, I mean, you know, you can have sympathetic characters, you can have characters in background, whatever, but you have to kind of carve out more explicitly space of here are the spaces that the player characters are intended to embody. And then, again, down the road, we can open things up if there's a strong interest in exploring other areas, not slavery, but, I mean, other areas that, you know, we kind of currently have all the limits. You could say, okay, maybe we can expand those areas.
Right.
But in a live-action game, it's the vampire-elder problem.
Right.
Elders in tabletop games aren't really at the core of Vampire the Masquerade experience, are meant to be background. They're meant to be the NPCs you bounce off of, the NPCs that move you around the board. In a live-action game, someone has to play that character. So you start to move into, okay, we have to make them player character-ish, and then eventually player characters full stop. And that bleeds back into the tabletop game, and it becomes a cycle of, okay, where do those lines get drawn? And it's not necessarily good or bad, you have to be clearer, especially for the start of the experience. Here's where it is. Here's where the limits are. And then we can expand from there rather than just saying it's all open and we can pick anything you want.
Right. So I know that a lot of people were excited before the Kickstarter began. And I know that we're going to be doing manuscript reviews doing manuscript reviews as we've done for most of our Kickstarters recently. So can you tell me about the three new strains? Because that's what I have seen all over Facebook. Everybody was like, 24 strains, what do I do with myself? And I'm like, okay. And then I found out, like, the way they were reacting for a minute, because I haven't read the earlier stuff for Dystopia Rising yet, I thought we were going from like 12 to 24. They're like, there were only 21. And I'm like, oh, okay, so we have three new ones. So yeah, can you talk about those?
I can step back because there's a slightly different approach we're taking to strains.
Okay. Well, then please talk about that.
And actually, this is a nice thing because it talks about, a bit about the development process. When we first started talking about it, I approached it very directly. I mean, I was treating it a bit like an anniversary edition, since I wanted to be completely respectful of the property and make sure that I'm making sure all the cool stuff that people remember in the game are all present and correct. Actually, I mean, earlier on was like going, don't be disrespectful, please update the setting and make changes. We really need to put some life, and also some areas haven't aged well. They've become problematic over time. We need to address those.
Right.
And so I was able to kind of dig around and change. But one of the elements that is, like you said, there are 21 strains, and that's a lot of space in the book.
Yeah, I was kind of like, I feel like you get choice paralysis trying to figure out which strain you were going to be.
That was actually my concern. There's a reason why books like Vampire only have 7 options. The reason why in Pugmire you only have 6 callings is because there's, I think I've talked about this before, about you have 3 to 7 is your ideal sweet spot of choices.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go slightly above or below, but you really want to kind of keep it in that range. And 21 was just too many from that perspective. And also, it's just a ton of word count and a ton of art to make.
Mm-hmm.
If we do our classic 2-page spreads, that's 42 pages of the book and 21 mm-hmm. art pieces. And we're just doing, the first part of character creation. So the initial plan was, I was like, can I pull this back? We had a talk at midwinter 2017 about this. I was like, here's the outline, let's talk it through. And they're like, you cannot do all of the strains. I mean, great. So then the plan was to, and when we started writing the book, the core book was going to be a piece of North America, what is called the Northeast region. So it's kind of Eastern Canada, the East Coast of the U.S., a little bit of the Midwest, that kind of chunk. And we would just focus on the strains that are predominant in that area. So we picked 10. Like, we'll do 10 strains. And so I calculated the book out as that and so on and so forth. And one thing I said, I'm noticing as I'm trying to figure out which strains to choose, that there's a lot of overlap between these strains. For example, two of the more common ones, you have the Baywalkers and you have the Yorkers, and they have a rivalry. Baywalkers are kind of roughly Bostonian characters. The Yorkers are pretty clearly New Yorker characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kind of extrapolate the baseball rivalry between those two cities into an actual, like, Hatfield-McCoy-style feud.
Okay.
They hate each other on sight. But they kind of do the same stuff. They live in cities. They're kind of scavengers. There's a lot of ideological and just design space overlap between these characters. And so I was actually talking about that. And Michael Pucci, who I was working with, he's like, why don't we actually turn it into a feature? And so I went away. This is like during first drafts. So I mean, I got first drafts in and we're having this kind of, well, let's shift this, which doesn't usually happen in book development. But in this case, I think it was good because we decided that he helped me pan out. Here are the 8 rough archetypes of strains mm-hmm. as he saw them. Katie Griffin was the writer for it, also was heavily involved in DR. So she was able to help me to kind of work with him on that, to kind of articulate that relationship. And he said, here are the 8 groups and here's how they all play out. And so we have to have 3 more strains to kind of fill in those gaps. We do have 3 more options. But I don't actually want to talk about those because that's a good reason for people to pledge the Kickstarter to actually look at those.
Yeah.
What I'm actually personally excited about is that we were actually able to change some of the existing strains and give them a little more depth and also to remove some problematic elements. For example, one of the what we call lineages now. These are the kind of the uber strains.
Yeah, so it's eight lineages with three strains each under them. Is that
right,
how
yeah.
it's broken down? Okay.
Yeah, and actually that's a good, before I go into that, lineages are entirely a metagame concept. Very few people in the game world would go, oh, you're part of that lineage. Instead, it's more, you guys are kind of similar, even though you're claimed to be different strains. So the output, as I call it, is still a strain, and it still works exactly the same way as people have played Dystopia Rising in the past. So if they're familiar with how, say, Baywalkers and New Yorkers are, then they'll still act much the same, they still look the same, they still have the same rivalry. But mechanically speaking, they're both part of what we call the townies, which are the urban-based strains.
Okay.
And it actually adds an interesting bit of metafiction because part of the reason why they hate each other is they're ultimately, at a high level, the same family, but they don't even realize it.
Right. Which is, I mean, that's actually a cool metafiction thing that you see a lot in various fiction in general. It's like, you guys hate each other because you're the exact same person.
Right. But nothing in the game world broadcasts that. It's only the players that realize that.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And I think that's a fun kind of thing we get out of that. We also have a group called the Elites, which are basically the people who are a bit above everybody else, either because they think themselves to be above everybody else or because something has put them in a position of authority. One of the outputs of that was a strain that used to be called the Gaijins. And the concept, as I understand it, as it was explained to me, was that they were part of a Japanese company. They froze their people when the fall happened, and then they came out as a result of that. And so they're these kind of tech-based characters because they all stem from this Japanese company. But the idea is that even though the company is based in Japan and they took their name from the Japanese company, a lot of Japanese companies have a worldwide presence, so anyone could be a member of this. It's not specific mm-hmm. to that region.
Right.
But that's not how the player base extrapolated that.
Okay.
And also some of the fiction didn't necessarily make that as clear as it could have been. So it comes across as characters with rice hats and samurai armor, which wasn't the intent. So
right.
We switched that into what are now called the Digitarians. So we kind of, you know, some of them may have stemmed from this same corporation that totally exists and people can still play into that space if they want to. The Gaijin Corporation was still a corporation that existed before the fall and were part of the output that became the Digitarians. But there are also other companies that had similar experiments all over the world. And so Digitarians are just tech-obsessed strains. And because they need to have, they have access to higher technology than most people and are generally better with technology, that puts them in a higher plane with people, not because they are Japanese, which was kind of the unintentional output of that, but rather because they just have resources that nobody else has access to, and therefore that puts them into a slightly higher social ladder than other people.
Right.
That's kind of a quote-unquote new strain in a sense of it's a strain that's existed, but it's being presented in a new way. And it really is exciting for me because my work on, say, books like Vampire 20th Anniversary Edition were, how do we take the existing concepts and keep them valid while also quietly rewriting or expanding the material to be more inclusive and to slowly ditch problematic concepts. Whereas with this license, I was given explicit permission, go ahead and just rewrite it. And actually, I was even told you could just nuke them and get rid of them and then never show up again. I actually found a way to help make sure that they were still around, so people still had the space for that.
Mm-hmm.
But to give us a much larger, cooler concept. And because of this new design, there's a lot more we can do. Because we have these eight lineages, we can make even more strains. And the idea is that strains are largely regional. There's the third of the townies, or the Vagassians, which are kind of your gambler, adrenaline junkie kind of characters. They come from Vegasia, which is Vegas.
Yeah.
But they're not called Vegasians when they're not in Vegasia, but they have the same kind of rough template.
Well, yeah,
but this way.
Yeah, sorry.
So go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay, sorry, we're bad at this. And, like, you're occasionally cutting out on my end, so I keep, like, accidentally trying to fill in silence.
Oh.
Sorry about that.
Fair enough. But, like, with the original structure, if you wanted to say play characters from Atlantic City, whatever that is in Dystopia Rising, then you basically would be... They would be called Vegasians. They have the Vegasian template. And even though the fiction might be they're called something else, players are actually going to go with what the actual word in the book is.
Right. So
they're going to be called Vegasians.
So speaking of which, what is the setting for Dystopia Rising? You mentioned North America. You mentioned Atlantic City. You mentioned Vegas. So, like, what's... Like, is it a global game like some of our games are? Can you play anywhere in the world? Or does it have to be, you know, North America-ish based? Like, where can you play Dystopia Rising Evolution?
So, unlike most of our games, you're right, it is very regional based. And that was an intentional decision for a couple of reasons. One is that a lot of the Dystopia Rising live action chapters are based in North America, and particularly the United States. And so it, by default, has a strong American feel. Another piece of it, however, is that I wanted to reflect, again, on the meta level, the fact that there's not a lot of communication between areas. The area that we consider North America is much more fragmented because there's just not easy travel around this very large chunk of land that we have.
Right.
And I wanted to encourage people to explore, and there's certainly an element of road trip in this design that you can't get in a LARP, but you can do in a tabletop game. So there's reasons to kind of explore the larger area than just this settlement I live in. But I still wanted to kind of reflect the fact that this is not an easy place to travel. So the core book is, like I mentioned, the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the location areas are corruptions of language that we understand. It's kind of a fun thing. It's the fun game that we play sometimes a little bit with Pugmire, but it's a lot more prevalent in this game. And the example settlement we have is set in Philadelphia. Was called the Delphian Wastes originally. In the Delphian Wastes, they've managed to scrape together in the past few years an actual settlement called Philadelphia. So Philadelphia is kind of the... Here's the example settlement you can use with a bunch of NPCs and story hooks, so people can dive right into an existing template. And also, it's a game that's not been previously established by a live-action franchise, so people, even from live-action games, aren't going to come in with preconceived notions. Everyone's starting on the same blank page in terms of what this settlement is and what it can be. It has no past history.
Right.
And the idea is that we'll do probably, if the line does well and if we're very happy with it and if Eshami is happy with it, we can then do source books for other regions and also introduce more strains through there very naturally. If we do like a book that covers the Northwest area with Vegasia and California, whatever, we can then introduce regional strains there that make sense and are interesting and compelling. So it's a nice way to balance new player bits with regional space that we're covering. Right.
And if this game line does go on, does do well, you know, we do actually get to produce, you know, 30 books for it. Who knows?
Right.
Would you want eventually to do like, here's what was happening with, you know, the strain of the Grave Mind in Asia, and here's what was happening in England, and here's what was happening in South America? Or do you think it would just be like a lot of North American regions?
No, I do eventually want to do world books, but my current kind of vague idea, and I've talked this over with Ashton Media, and they're kind of keen on the idea, but we're not committing to any of this. This is more kind of if I had my druthers, and like I said, we had 30 books and everything's wonderful, is to actually do new source books. Because... and it's a shame that Matthew had to duck out, but British post-apocalyptic fiction is distinctly different from American post-apocalyptic fiction, and Chinese post-apocalyptic fiction is also distinct from both of those.
Right.
And so tweaking and modifying the core conceits of the game in ways that are compatible so that all the games can play together, but also address what each of those fiction genres find compelling,
mm-hmm.
I find that particularly interesting because... Day of the Triffids, for example, is we kind of joke about it, and the movie was kind of laughable, but
right.
At its core, it's about what it's like to live through the Blitz of mm-hmm. World War II. that's a lot of British post-punk fiction comes from, we've done this before, let's do it again, kind of stiff upper lip mentality. And it's a lot of fiction about staying put and carrying on and getting through it. The Omega Factor is another British television show that kind of the same idea is. There's not a lot of moving around, and so that gets its different tone, whereas both Mad Max and Walking Dead, the counterpoints I mentioned, both of them involve characters leaving from one place and going to another place on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, that's partially just geography. You know, if you look at, right. like, there's not a whole lot of places to go in England. That's why, like, even, I think the only media I can, like, super think of just right off the top of my head is, like, 28 Days Later would be the only one right. where it is, like, there's a journey happening. But mm-hmm. even that one, you know, get to the end and they're on a coast. They don't really have anywhere else to go at that point. And so they're staying okay. put to be rescued at that point. Yeah, so it's like, that's really interesting because especially with the mechanics you were describing earlier with, like, scrap, you have to keep moving, et cetera, wouldn't really work in a staying put kind of game.
It exactly, right.
It would work better in a keep moving game.
Right, and I feel like there's enough small pieces changing, and because it's also a relatively blank slate, there aren't many franchises outside of the United States, so that's material that we can actually develop and write up, and also we can hire people who live in these various areas who are either steeped in the fiction or at least aware of it, and some of the cultural values they have to try to make sure those games are compelling to children, right, so we can do kind of half edition changes, you know, mm-hmm. like we can also, if we do the European book in a couple of years, then we can, you know, quietly roll in some of the rule changes we found over the past couple of years from the first edition. So it's not quite, the third edition of Evolution or second edition of Evolution, but rather it's kind of its own little, like, 3.5 step, if you will, to use D&D reference. Mm-hmm. But also, like I say, you know, we can dig into that stuff a bit more, and then we could do source books based off of that specific slice, and it also allows people a fresh start. That's the other thing that I was worried about was because this is a franchise that has now close to 10 years of history associated with it, and it's living, ongoing history.
Right.
I did not want that to be unapproachable for people who have never played a Dystopia Rising game, never heard of Dystopia Rising. I want them to be able to come to this book, go, oh, this is a cool post-apocalyptic game, and can have a satisfying experience having never once even acknowledge the existence of the live action group.
Yeah, totally. Well, because it's one of your lines, that's one that, like, I'm only kind of familiar with between, you know, sharing a booth with Eschaton. I've got a couple of friends now that play, so I see posts occasionally about the LARP on Facebook. Mm-hmm. But because we are doing the Kickstarter pre-editing, I haven't read the book yet. Like, I have not even seen the outline, so I don't know what else going into it, which is why, like, interviewing you is kind of fun, because on some level, like, I am learning all this stuff with all the listeners who don't know about Yay! It either. But as someone who, like, used to be, like, I was super into zombie movies for a long time. I kind of fell off of a lot of my zombie media. And mm-hmm. this seems interesting to me. Like, I would actually like to play this. Because, you know, like everything in the horror cycle, first vampires got played out for a while, and then zombies have been played out for a little while. You kind of get right. to a saturation point where you're like, I don't want to see any more zombie movies, or I don't want to see any more vampire movies, or whatever. Just because it seems like every movie or TV show that comes out is that thing. Right. But because this has the elements of Mad Max and a Fallout and a Borderlands 2 and also emotional connections, and also it's futuristic, which is really cool because it's not just like Day After Tomorrow. It is actually like more futuristic than that. So they might not, characters in Dystopia Rising Evolution, I think you were telling me a while back, like they're just not going to know stuff that we know in 2018. Because it's so far removed that they have forgotten these things culturally. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And actually, that's something that I found really interesting because I believe the reason why I was asked to do the line was because Eddie is involved with action groups. He knows how this live action thing works. So he's the best person to migrate a live action game to a tabletop game. I think it's probably the extent of, okay, cool, he'll do it. But also, because of my work on Pugmire, there is some overlap there. Pugmire obviously is a very, very, very different output in that respect. Mm-hmm. But the same sense of our own current history as archaeological knowledge is, I think, core to both of those, to a certain degree.
Yeah, I think Pugmire is even more removed because Pugmire is like they're not people. So no, they're kind of going like,
they're,
I don't know.
They're people. Hey, they're people.
They're not humans. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You know what I mean.
But you're right, yeah. And also, that's I mean, even though I've never given it a time frame, comfortably, Pugmire is thousands of years in the future.
Right.
Whereas Soapy Rising is probably maybe a century on the outside.
Okay.
So,
like four or five generations tops?
Yeah, I mean, four generations is what's listed.
Okay.
So there's no one alive who remembers the fall.
Right.
So a lot of the history is oral tradition in some respect. Even though people are starting to write things down and share information, it still ultimately stems from oral tradition because the first generation people were just basically just trying to live through it.
Right.
And then once they had children, there was some kind of, let me tell you some stuff I remember, but it's all from their hazy recollections of how life worked.
Mm-hmm.
And then so that's why, you get the kind of fun corruptions of, for example, they're one of the faiths called the Telling Visionaries.
Oh, my gosh. That's such a great name.
It is. And the Telling Visionaries, they have salvaged and passed on television shows, radio shows, taking them as gospel because there are these beams that are coming from the sky that give us information that we must follow. And so on one surface, it's an excuse to be goofy. It's your junk yawns from Transformers the movie. It's pop culture spouting things that are taken completely out of context, and mm-hmm. therefore there's an element of humor that comes from that. Again, it's akin to a certain degree to the Pugmire style of humor. But on another level, they're not wrong. I mean, they're the closest anybody has to preserving what actually existed before.
Right.
They're just misinterpreting it. And, you know, the fact is that our past lives, the people who came before us, are giving us vital knowledge that we need to keep is not inherently a wrong-minded concept. So there's an interesting kind of tension between how much ignorance they have and how much they realize they have, because at a certain level they know we don't have all the information, and they're trying to fill in the gaps and they're just not filling them in well. There's a strain called the Murricans, which are obviously a corruption of American, and the default type is very kind of rugged South Mason-Dixon line stereotypes. So there's lots of cowboy hats, lots of drawls and the like, and how they act out this kind of rugged farmer style lifestyle stems from a pop culture understanding of how people in the South live.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not also coming from a place of complete invalidity. There are people who do live like that, who are hardworking people who try to reclaim the lands. In this case, they're reclaiming the land not by farming, but by shooting zombies and trying to clear areas.
Right.
And the fact that they're rugged and not maybe keen on all subtle social cues is because they don't need those things to survive in these hard-to-live areas.
Yeah.
There is a different kind of meta humor. It's definitely a darker humor than a game like, say, Pugmire. And I think from talking with other people who play Dystopia Rising, I think it's part of the fun for them is to how do we take these concepts and twist them into ways that we find funny but also are deadly serious to the characters that think about and talk about them. But it is different in the sense that they still have a handle on what society used to be like. As mm-hmm. opposed to Pugmire, where it's complete blank slate, and they're just starting from scratch functionally.
Right.
And they're trying to piece things together as best they can. In this case, it's like there are bits and pieces that have come down, but it's like a very generational game of telephone.
Right. So
it's like my grandfather told me, and blah, 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 and it gets changed each way.
So I think that one of my probably last questions, because we're getting towards time, would be during the fall, which happened, you know, whenever it happened. I don't know if there's like a canonical date for that. But, Did all books and everything explode too? Like, is that like how is that hand waved in the setting that like they can't acquire actual hard information?
Right. So while the fall's not given an actual canonical date, it's kind of assumed to have been roughly now. So 10 years ago, it was roughly 2008. Now it's roughly 2018.
Right.
If we do another edition, it'll be roughly 2028. But the idea is that anything after the mid-90s is more or less done. Because of the fragility of computer technology and our increased networking and computerization of technology.
Mm-hmm.
When EMPs go off, a lot of electromagnetic static goes off, a lot of stuff's going to be just wiped. So a lot of music created in the past 15 years is going to be gone because it's mostly MP3s now or Spotify or streaming. If those things shut off, where'd the music go? You know, unless you have an actual hard-pressed record. So much like how, like, say, Fallout is kind of roughly set in the 50s.
Yeah.
From a technological perspective and a culture perspective, DR is kind of closer to the 90s. So books certainly exist. Obviously, with all the devastation, a lot of them get destroyed. And
right.
The other piece is that a lot of this stuff is missing because we're four generations of survivors. So I can preserve this book about how to build a bridge, or I can burn it and make a fire for myself for tonight.
Okay.
Those are kinds of decisions that happened early on. So a lot of stuff is missing between the fall of humanity and people making strategic decisions from day-to-day lifestyle choice of can I survive the night. There's a lot of gaps in that knowledge.
Okay.
So it's not completely at the hand wave of everything gone, but also, well, and people got rid of stuff. You know, concepts like democracy and the like are still more prevalent than they were, again, like Sam Pugmire, because those kinds of things, people who banded together ultimately used systems of government they recognized.
Right.
And some of them certainly would have tried completely different new forms of governments. But like, for example, the faiths that are present in DR would call creeds, none of them come from an existing known religion. And there's obviously out-of-game reasons why I made that choice. But in-game, it's, well, obviously those faiths didn't do us any good.
Right.
So, I mean, there are still going to be biblical references and the like that are just kind of colloquial. Eye for an eye, that kind of stuff, still going to be around. And some people may even recognize where it came from. But it's the context for it is muted and blurred.
Right.
Because key chunks are missing. So, again, it's still just starting from scratch. It's more just, okay, but why is this way? And I liken it to a lot of software, when you have the save icon, there's a little picture of a diskette. Or when you call someone on Skype, you see a little hand, a receiver.
Right.
But those things haven't been around for 15 years. And already we're reaching a point where people are like, why is the call thing shaped like that? The phone doesn't look like that. The phone looks like a square box.
right. Yeah. And like people wondering about, like I said, like, or like you said, the like save icon. They're like, what is this thing? Like, it's a disk. Didn't you?
Right.
Oh my God, I'm old. Oh God.
Right. And it's a disk. You put into your computer, you save things on it. It's like, why would you do that? That makes no sense, you know? So we are still around to give the context for these things. But if you remove that piece and then you try to, again, it's the archaeology of our modern society. Okay, why does this exist this way? I can try to guess that this glyph means something involving the preservation of information, but I don't know what the context is anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how it works, is that key people died, key institutions went away, and then more of those people died and more of that stuff went away as people tried to survive. And the people that are left, there's a lot more land than there is people right now, at least in the North American side of things.
Mm-hmm.
The survivors are, there's no hard numbers, but I would guess something like a tenth of the original population, if that. So there's a lot less people around. And those people around weren't always keen with preserving how things worked. So if you come across 100 years later a stop sign, you know, is that, what is the context for a stop sign? Why is it there? What does it mean? Or is it just a chunk of metal I stripped down and used to help patch my car?
Right. That makes sense. So just to wrap up, and this should be a shorter answer, I hope. What is your favorite thing that you have gotten to introduce to this version of Dystopia Rising? Whether you were one of the writers, but like favorite new thing.
So it's not going to be a short answer, but I'll try to keep it
short. No, that's fine. We can go over a little bit. We always end up going to like 115, 120, so.
It's true. One of the things that I was very passionate about is disability inclusivity in the book.
Okay.
Because there is a perception, which I find to be wrongheaded, of the idea that if you're disabled, you'll die in the apocalypse. So there are no disabled people in post-apocalyptic genre, mm-hmm. which is objectively not true. What happens in post-apocalyptic genre is a lot of people acquire disabilities through the act of survival.
True.
So, you know, people lose eyes, they lose hands, they lose motion in their legs, whatever. So I have always felt that disability inclusion is more important in post-apocalyptic fiction than most other genres of fiction because it is more prevalent, even though people don't recognize it as such.
Mm-hmm.
So not only was I passionate about that, but actually three of the writers on the book also have various different disabilities. And so there's a lot of conversations about how I wanted to pitch that. And there's a lot of great stuff about how to use mobility aids, how to present people with disabilities, how to tie that into the mechanics, and also just things like the various values of some of these elements. One of the combat examples is one of the characters is using a cane because they're lame in one leg, and they're walking along and they attack by zombies, and so you'll swing on zombies with your cane. That's a natural reaction. So you have a kind of a built-in weapon that you can use.
Right.
And if you know that this is you're going to be attacked on a regular basis, you're going to reinforce and develop that cane and build it out in ways that allow you to use it as a weapon and as an assisted aid.
Yeah, have the most badass cane ever.
Is exactly right. So it was something that I thought was important, something that I'm still working with art on because, it's natural for artists to kind of include able-bodied people. So I'm trying to kind of, as we get more art in, okay, can we give them more visible disabilities, but also just in text recognizing their invisible disabilities. And that's both, if you have a disability in the wasteland, it's because you are extremely tough in other ways. And just recognizing that, and whether you acquired disability through your existence in the wasteland or you grew up with a disability, the fact that you're a player character means you're tough in other ways, and so we're not going to erase your disability, but rather we're going to show that it is possible to live in this environment in this way. So that's something I'm personally very passionate and excited about.
Yeah, showing that they're both tough and also valuable, because with the party, like... especially if you're talking about somebody who uses like a wheelchair, for instance, which is I'm sure a lot more difficult in DR because mm-hmm. roads and things are not really meant for that, and of course things like the electric wheelchairs and all that are so common today aren't really gonna work at that point. Mm-hmm. So like having someone who brings value to the team, it's great, and showing that these people are maybe even the most valuable members of the team, and that's why the rest of the team cares about helping them too. So yeah, exactly that's absolutely awesome. And I love the more, and this is like a total like broad industry strokes thing, but the more inclusivity I see happening in the industry, the happier I get. And I feel like people are talking about it on lines of, race, gender, sexual orientation a lot. And I feel like disability doesn't come up as much, and I think it should.
Yeah, you're right. It absolutely doesn't.
So, like, I know that for me, especially having worked with you and also having worked with various other writers and things who have various disabilities, I'm sure you're more aware of it now, especially when I talk about inclusivity, when I talk about that, whether it's on a podcast or whether I talk about it, in blogs or in panels. I know I'm going to try to do better in the future, just because I've talked to all of y'all now, especially mm-hmm. at Gen Con, between talking to you and our friend Mandy and our friend Shoshana. There are a few different people who kind of brought that to my attention. And I was like, you know what? I don't know if I watch out for that one as much as I watch out for gender, race, sexuality, right. etc. And I really should. So yeah, no, that's awesome that you're able to bring that into the game and actually add some mechanics to it, and that it's going to be in the artwork. I mean, that's amazing to hear.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that because it is not talked about that much. It's something I personally tried not to force it in because it's. You need to find a natural way to have the conversation, and I thought the post-apocalyptic genres is a great place to do so. I really want to take advantage of that opportunity to kind of showcase, like, hey, this is a thing where you see these people with disabilities all the time, but your brain doesn't process it as such. So here's a way to normalize this conversation.
Well, yeah, because like it's so common for someone to lose an eye. I mean, that was something that I know when Mad Max Fury Road came out. People were so excited about Furiosa,
right?
And being being a strong disabled woman who was the lead of this movie. And I think that that's something that DR really lends itself to. So mm-hmm. let's do it. Yeah, awesome. Okay, cool. Well, Eddie, thank you for having been our guest this episode.
I hope you'll invite me back soon.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I don't know. We don't.
Oh.
So how can people find you on social media since you are the guest? I'll let you do your thing.
Oh, thank you. you can find me at just about any social media website at Eddie Fate, EDDYFATE. You can find me at eddiefate.com. You can also find me at pugsteady.com. And if you're interested about Pugmire, you can find out more at realmsofpugmire.com.
Awesome.
And Matthew? Oh, Matthew.
Yeah, I was actually going to do his forum, so.
Oh, okay.
So, Matthew, who is unfortunately no longer with us, he's in the desert finding himself on some kind of quest. I don't know what he's doing. You can find him on Twitter at clackclickbang. You can find him on YouTube in the Onyx Path forums at The Gentleman Gamer. And you can also see him all over the various White Wolf social media pages and Onyx Path social media pages, just as Matthew Dawkins. That's his name. You can find me on Twitter at Dixie Cyanide and most other social media, Instagram, Onyx Path forums, etc. You can find us as a company at theonyxpath.com. Please, if you get a chance to go on iTunes or Google Play, rate and review the podcast, give us 5 stars if you like us. I'd say something nice. I like that. I'd love to hear comments. There will be a link to the Dystopia Rising Evolution Kickstarter in the show notes. Past that, if you, Google Dystopia Rising Kickstarter, you'll probably find it, which is cool. It is ongoing. It's only still got a week and a half in right now, so about 2.5 weeks to go. I am excited, once this goes live, to see where we are with it. So,
absolutely.
Thank you for listening. We will be back next week with some kind of episode. Don't know what yet. And as always, many worlds, one podcast.